We hope you enjoy this episode of the Modern Divorce Podcast. But first, an important message for our listeners.
Hi, this is attorney Billy Tarasio, and my partner Julie and I have created a resource for you if you are representing yourself in family court. No one should go into family court without knowing the basics, and we will teach you everything you need to know at Win Without Law School to represent yourself with confidence. We'll teach you how to get exhibits in, how to draft your pretrial statements, and how to speak to the judge so the judge will listen. We'll teach you how to defend against false accusations and everything you need to know to be an effective advocate, both if you're negotiating or if you're presenting evidence. Don't wait. Go to winwithoutlawschool.com. We can help you.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Modern Divorce Podcast. I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Malia Woodward, an associate attorney here at Modern Law. I'm your host, Billy Tarasio, owner of Modern Law. Malia, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good.
Nice. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. We like to have a podcast with every single attorney that works at Modern Law so that people can really get to know you. Now, you have such an interesting background. Law is your second career.
Yes.
So, and your background is in mental health, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your path before you became a lawyer.
So I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. And I started working in Colorado, where I worked for about 7.5 years with juveniles who had committed a sex offense and their families. I was in the home. I was at their school. I attended court, which was where I got my first real exposure to what attorneys can do for kids. So I did that for about 7.5 years. And then I moved to Arizona, where I became a director of a community mental health agency. And it was more geared towards adults. But I also, as part of that clinic, I ran a opioid replacement treatment facility and opened up the children's side of things and things like that. And then weaving in all of that, I became a foster parent. And so did a lot with that side of my mental health.
Wow. You are hardcore. You're not, I mean, you're not just a licensed marriage and family therapist. You've worked with youth sex offenders, with drug addicts, with families in the system. And then you have also been a family in the system, not in the way that you had your children in dependency, but you were a foster parent.
Yes.
And now you're an adoptive mom to these kids.
Yes.
So yes. Exciting.
Yes, it is. It is.
And then you were so hardcore. You're like, nope, I don't like being here. I want to be the lawyer.
Pretty much. Yes. My career constantly touched court, and I saw the impact, and particularly my time in Colorado, I saw how much the attorney, the guardian ad litem, was listened to over me, the therapist, who was in the home 3 to 4 times a week. And I was like, I want that impact.
Yes.
I became a therapist to have impact, and I want that. And so when I had an opportunity to rethink my career, I said, I'm going to law school.
You're entirely right. There is immediate deference to lawyers. Immediate.
Yeah.
Across society. It's just you're immediately trusted and listened to. And I don't think that's right, but it is right, but it is what it is. So
right.
We talk about family law a ton on this podcast. I want to know from you, what have you learned about juvenile sex offenders? Because this does come up in family law cases.
So my experience with juvenile sex offenders is they're no different than adolescents who are out doing things like using drugs or skipping school or becoming members of gangs. They are acting out the way they are choosing to act out is a completely unacceptable way to society. Not that drugs is acceptable, but we kind of have expected it of teenagers when they act out. Oh, they're going to use drugs, or they're going to, you know, get into mom and dad's liquor cabinet or whatever. These juveniles just, for whatever reason, go in a way that society just will not and cannot accept. But what I also have found time and time again is that if you get them into treatment while they are young, their recidivism, meaning they're going to do it again, decreases significantly, like in the 0 to 10% range.
So I think this is worth talking about because you're not the first person who's told me this. I've had other people on the podcast who've said the same thing. And I think that juveniles acting inappropriate sexually is really common. And I think sometimes parents are afraid to say anything or to intervene because it is so unacceptable. And mm-hmm. it is unacceptable. But mm-hmm. failing to intervene is like allowing your child to be a drug addict.
Right. Yes. Yes. I would say intervening, while it's hard, and some of the, actually, I would say the majority of the kids that I worked with, their victim was a family member, whether that was a step sibling, a sibling in the home, a cousin. So this was not just them. This was tearing apart a whole family, extended family at times. But what I found time and time again is intervening, doing something is better for both the child who is offending and the child who has been victimized.
Right.
Time and time again, I've seen that. But that doesn't understate how incredibly and emotionally hard it is.
Sure. But the alternative is much worse.
Yes, the alternative is much worse because the potential victimizing continues and more victims are added, and that child is never held accountable, nor is that victim ever heard or really believed, right, depending on if they speak out. And so it's one of those things that when I come across it, when I was practicing mental health, when I come across it, I always encourage that client, report. I am right here with you to make that report. Report, do something about it. In the long run, it is worth it. It's going to be a marathon, not a sprint, but it's always, always been worth it.
So this also happens, it comes up a lot in family law cases where one parent, a child discloses to one parent that something has happened at the other parent's house. Mm-hmm. And we then file a petition for modification, or we call DCS. Many, many times, these things cannot be substantiated. What can a parent do to intervene if you're unable to get the justice system to work because there's not enough evidence?
So one of the things that we do is it's as simple as holding that child accountable. So when they are, if it would be ideal if both parents were on board, I'll just put that out there right away. And if both parents are on board, then both of them holding them accountable where they are monitored as far as, and I'm not talking about like put them in jail kind of monitored, but you know where they are and you know where that person who reported the abuse is. And so you're keeping safe, and you're essentially sending the message to that child who reported and said, I hear you. I get that the justice system maybe didn't hear you, but I hear you, and I'm going to protect you, even if maybe it really didn't happen. But I'm going to believe you because it's that big of a deal to me. And then on the side of the kid who is acting out, holding them accountable as far as having conversations with them about, and their uncomfortable conversations, mm-hmm. 100%. Not fun, but important. Mm-hmm. Just like you talk to your kids about drugs, Talk to him about sexuality. Mm-hmm. Talk to him about what is appropriate, mm-hmm. and create that open forum where they will come and talk to you about, hey, you know, this happened at school, or hey, this happened at home. What do I do about that? And so even if you can't get the justice system on your side or to hear that child, you can still put things in place by holding the one who offended accountable and protecting the one who was abused.
I see this a lot where the resolution for family court might be both parents agree to a specific safety plan,
mm-hmm.
and or counseling for the offending child. And there are specific programs for youth offenders, even if they're not going to jail, even if they've been convicted of nothing, it can be handled even if the cops don't arrest somebody.
100%. Yes. Yes.
How long does it take when you're intervening in this type of a situation?
It depends.
For you to feel confident, like, how do you know this offender is no longer a risk? It was a bad decisions. We've moved on. How do you know?
That's a hard thing. But I would say when I was the treatment provider, what I was looking for was, were the parents stepping in when something would happen, whether it was just as small as they didn't finish homework for school. You know, so were they stepping in places that I would want them to be stepping in? Were they aware of who their friends were? Were they monitoring, you know, behavior like access to a computer? Not saying that every juvenile accesses pornography, but that was just one of the things that we had to be aware of. And so were they monitoring? Number one is one of the things that I look for with a juvenile, with the actual teenager. I would be looking at, is there accountability? Are they denying still what they did? Or is there some level of accountability that, yeah, something happened, whether it's they full on admit it happened, which usually does have to happen when they go through the justice system. They have to acknowledge that they did what they did, compared to someone who the justice system isn't involved in and isn't saying, yep, we are on the side of the victim and we agree something happened. As long as they're acknowledging, yeah, my boundaries weren't appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We've got something that they're at least acknowledging. And then I would say also looking at, are we getting them moving in a normative developmental way? So are they practicing social skills? Are they involved in the school as far as whether that's sports or clubs or whatever, where they can get their social needs met? So those are the things that I would be looking for, with the two biggest being, are parents stepping in when I normally would as the therapist and have to encourage them to step in? Are they doing it instead? And then is the youth taking accountability?
Okay. That's really, really helpful, I think, because it does happen so often. Let's talk about your time as a foster parent and now an adoptive mom.
What do you want to know? I think there's a lot there. It was an eye-opening experience to different parents out there. My first placement, my daughter, I happen to have a fantastic relationship with their mom. I'm still in contact with her. We still do visits on occasion. She'll still send little notes to the kids for their birthdays and things like that. So we really have a positive relationship. And I think one of the things that created that, allowed that, is when I was trained as a foster parent, one of the things they talked about and that hit me was, you are not just fostering this child. Your job is to continue to encourage that relationship with the biological parent. And so some of the ways they talked about it was like, you called the child by the name that the parent calls the child. Whether or not you like it, you call them by that, so that they're that child is constantly receiving the message of, yeah, I'm in line with your mom. Doesn't mean I agree with what your mom or dad are doing, but I'm in line with them. You're communicating with them. So my takeaway was, I'm fostering this child, but I'm also fostering this parent too.
You were co-parenting.
Yeah, I was.
You were co-parenting.
I was. I had a back and forth book.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that relationship didn't work with every child that I fostered. But I tried to create that relationship. I was always open and available. I had a back and forth book with every one of my kids. But some of them were more willing to meet me and others not so much. And that was okay. But at the end of the day, I was always there to support that relationship with the biological parent.
So the thing that is so valuable about this is that many of our parents struggle with co-parenting. It's hard. You don't like your ex. You might think they're doing a terrible job with your kids. They might even be doing a terrible job with your kids. We co-parent and we lift that person up, not for the other parent's benefit, but for the child's benefit, which is something that you have had to experience.
Yes. 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 And it is hard with my kid's biological mom. It was easy to do because when I first met her, I realized she's a child. Mm. She was 22, maybe years old, and she had no one to guide her in being a parent herself. And so I saw that compared to my other parents that I've experienced. They did not want to hear from me in any way, shape, or form. And so when they would do something, I always had someone. It was my agent, my licensing agent. She was always there for me to be that person to kind of vent to. And then I could vent, let it all out, and then take a step back and say, okay, what should my response be to help this child? At the end of the day, mm-hmm. this child, their growth, their development, their health is more important than my feelings being hurt or even these parents' feelings being hurt. So, and again, I would use that person to be kind of that bouncing off of, as far as like, well, this is how I think I should respond. What do you think? And they would tell me, no, that's a little mean. Dial it back. Or, yeah. You know, whatnot.
And you are a single adoptive mother, correct?
Yes, I am. Yes.
You're a single mom. I mean, Belia, you've done it all. You have done it all. You're such a role model for all of us.
Thank you.
So how old are your kids now?
They are 6 and 7.
6 and 7. And how long have they been with you?
My daughter, when she came to me, she was 2.5 months old.
Oh, wow.
And she has been with me pretty much that whole time.
Got it.
And my son was 6 months.
Okay. All right. So what are some keys to successful single parenting as an attorney?
You know, when I got ready to go to law school, I sat down with a judge and I asked her a question. I said, what's going to help me be successful in law school? And she knew. She was the judge who did my adoption and everything like that. So we had a great working relationship. And she said, treat law school like your full-time job and then be mom when you are not at school. And so when I was at school, that's one of the things that I would do, is I was at school from 8 till 5. And then at 5, I picked up my kids and everyone knew, my friends, everyone knew. 5 o'clock, don't call Malia unless it's an emergency. And from 5 till 7, when my little kids went to bed, I was 100% theirs. And it had to be an emergency. And even when I was a foster parent, my staff, they learned that pretty quickly too. 5 o'clock would hit, I was out that door picking up my kids. And unless there was blood or a robbery or something emergent, leave Malia alone until about 7:30. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I've carried on into being an attorney is 5 o'clock, 5:30. If I'm commuting, then I am mom until 7:30. And then after that, I can come back to being an attorney, but it is really hard to come back to being a mom after the kids have gone to bed.
Got it. Okay. So you're very protective of your mom time.
Yes.
And present for that time. That's something that's so hard to do because it's hard to turn off the day, especially when you're an attorney, because now you have, you know, all these people whose lives you're responsible for. Does that feel different as a lawyer than it did as a therapist, or is that very similar?
It's very similar because you're always thinking about that client and you're always wondering, well, what can I do? Or how do I help them understand? Or how can we move from point A to point B, you know, kind of thing. So you're always thinking about those things in the background, but I learned to, when my kids need me, I shut that off and I kind of file that away for, I will come back to that. Mm-hmm. And I do, I come back to it when, I have a notebook that sits next to me and it gets jotted down. Or I find that in those quiet moments, when I'm laying down with my kids and we're listening to a song and I'm not really speaking, I'm just laying there being with them, my head is working and I am solving things and things will just come to me because I am relaxed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to force it. I don't mm-hmm. know if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. It's the shower. It's the, yes. And I've read actually that it's, you get more alpha waves, maybe like your brain waves are changing, your brain wave pattern changes. And then you get, you know, you get creativity. And so I love that. I love that very much. What are your favorite types of family law cases and who are your favorite types of family law clients?
Oh, I would say my favorite types of family law cases. I am passionate about kids. And so custody cases are definitely something that I enjoy doing. I would say my favorite, I would also add adoption, mm-hmm. Is also a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. And then my favorite kind of client is a client that I would say, I'm not sure how to say this, is, for the custody portion of things, is just as focused on what's best for their child than getting revenge. I think for me, that's the client that I really feel like, yes, you get this. You see the impact that this is having on your child, and everything you're doing is really truly for that best interest of the child, kind of concept. So I love working with those kinds of parents that they can set aside the emotional hurt, the anger, the distrust, and say, you know what? They still love their child. And I can hate them for what they did to our marriage, but I can still appreciate the fact that they love our son or our daughter or, you know, whomever. And I'm not going to hurt my child just because they ruined or they hurt us in our marriage.
Awesome. I love that so much. Malia, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for sharing a little bit about your background and your practice. Anyone would be lucky to work with you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Modern Divorce Podcast. Remember, anything you've heard today or anything you read online is not the replacement for actual consultation with an attorney and does not create an attorney-client relationship. Even if you called in and we spoke to you, you are anonymous and we don't have your details and you have not become a client of Modern Law. However, we would love to speak with you, or you should seek out the advice of legal counsel or counseling or any other expert near you. And if you have an idea for a show topic or you need to speak with an attorney in Arizona, you can reach me at info@mymodernlaw.com.